referring to something called the federal funds rate, the rate that banks charge when they borrow from each other. The banks are required to keep a specific fraction of their deposits on reserve, as opposed to lent out, to be available for customer withdrawal. Banks can find themselves below the reserve requirement set by the Fed if they have made a lot of loans, or if an unusually large number of people have withdrawn funds. Banks borrow from each other when they need additional cash reserves to meet the reserve requirement. The federal funds rate rises when there is too much demand from banks looking to borrow and too little supply from banks willing to lend. For reasons we shall see in a moment, the Fed often wants to prevent the federal funds rate from rising. Although it cannot directly set the rate, it can intervene in the economy in such a way as to push it upward or downward. The way it pushes the rate down is by buying bonds from the banks. That gives the banks more money, and therefore more reserves on hand to lend to banks that need it. Funds available to be lent to other banks are now less scarce, and a correspondingly lower federal funds rate reflects this. Where does the Fed get the money to buy the bonds? It creates it out of thin air, simply writing checks on itself and giving them to banks. If that sounds fishy, then you understand it just fine. Here, finally, is how the Fed's activity leads to lower interest rates offered by banks. Thanks to Fed purchases of bonds from the banks now have excess reserves they can lend, either to other banks or to individuals or corporations. In order to attract additional borrowers, though, they must lower their interest rates, reduce their lending standards, or both. When the Fed intervenes like this, increasing the money supply with money and credit it creates out of thin air, it causes all kinds of economic problems. It decreases the value of the dollar, thereby making people poorer. And in the long run, even the apparent stimulus to the economy that comes from all the additional borrowing and spending turns out to be harmful as well. For this phony prosperity actually sows the seeds for hard times and recession down the road. First, consider the effects of inflation, by which we mean the Fed's increase in the supply of money on the value of the dollar. By increasing the supply of money, the Federal Reserve lowers the value of every dollar that already exists. If the supply of Mickey Mantle baseball cards were suddenly to increase a millionfold, each individual card would become almost valueless. Same principle applies to money. The more the Fed creates, the less value each individual monetary unit possesses. When the money supply is increased, prices rise. With each dollar now worth less than before, it can purchase fewer goods than it could in the past. Or imagine an art auction in which bidders are each given an additional $1 million. Would we not expect bids to go up? The market works the same way, except in a free market, there are numerous sellers instead of the one seller in an auction. All right, some may say, prices may indeed rise, but so do wages and salaries, and therefore inflation causes no real problems on net. This misconception overlooks one of the most insidious and immoral effects of inflation. It's redistribution of wealth from the poor and middle class to the politically well-connected. The price increases that take place as a result of inflation do not occur all at once and to the same degree. Those who receive the new money first receive it before prices have yet risen. They enjoy a windfall. Meanwhile, as they spend the new money and the next wave of recipients spend it and so on, prices begin to rise throughout the economy well before the new money has trickled down to most people. The average person is now paying higher prices while still earning his old income, which has not yet been adjusted to account for the higher money supply. By the time the new money has made its way throughout the economy, average people have all this time been paying higher prices and only now can begin to break even. The enrichment of the politically well-connected, in other words, those who get the newly created money first, government contractors, big banks, and the like, comes at the direct expense of everyone else. These are known as the distribution effects, or Cantillon effects, of inflation, after economist Richard Cantillon. The average person is silently robbed through this invisible means and usually doesn't understand what exactly is happening to him. And almost no one in the political establishment has an incentive to tell him. I have already discussed health care, but it's important to understand that rising health care costs cannot be understood apart from the money question. With the government so heavily involved in medicine, that is where so much of the new money is directed. Thus, health costs tend to rise faster than other costs because of the distribution effects of inflation. Wherever government spends its new money, that is where higher prices will be most immediate and evident. When the value of American savings is deliberately eroded through inflation, that is a tax, albeit a hidden one. I call it the inflation tax, a tax that is all the more insidious for being so underhanded. Most Americans have no idea what causes it or why their standard of living is going down. Meanwhile, government and its favored constituencies receive their ill-gotten loot. The racket is safe as long as no one figures out what is going on. Incidentally, wise Americans from our nation's past understood the damage that unbacked paper money could do to society's most vulnerable. "The rise of prices that follows an expansion of paper money," wrote William Gouge, Andrew Jackson's Treasury advisor, "does not affect all descriptions of labor and commodities, at the same time, to an equal degree. Wages appear to be among the last things that are raised. The working man finds all the articles he uses in his family rising in price, while the money rate of his own wages remains the same." Jackson himself warned that an inflationary monetary policy by means of spurious paper currency is always attended by a loss to the laboring classes. Likewise, Senator Daniel Webster maintained that of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been found more effectual than that which deludes them with paper money. Moreover, the inflation rate itself, which is tracked using the Consumer Price Index, CPI, tends to be measured in a misleading way. Ask the average American if he thinks prices are going up by only a few percent per year, as the official figures would have it. So-called core inflation figures do not include food or energy, prices for which have been rising rapidly. But there is another, more significant way in which these kinds of measurements of inflation are designed to obscure rather than reveal. Ludwig von Mises used to say that governments will always try to get people to focus on prices when thinking about inflation, but rising prices are a result of inflation, not inflation itself. Inflation is the increase in the money supply. If we understood inflation that way, we would instantly know how to cure it. Simply demand that the Federal Reserve cease increasing the money supply. By focusing our attention on prices instead, we are liable to misdiagnose the problem, and we are more apt to accept bogus government solutions like wage and price controls as in the 1970s. Let's now consider what really happens when the Fed lowers interest rates. We often hear calls for the Fed to do just that, as if forcing rates down were a costless way to bring about permanent prosperity. The alleged prosperity it brings about is neither costless nor permanent. When the Fed artificially lowers rates, it misrepresents economic conditions and misleads people into making unsound investments. Investments that would not have been profitable beforehand suddenly seem attractive in light of the lower interest rates. These are malinvestments, which would not have been undertaken if the business world had been able to view the economy clearly instead of being misled by the Fed's false signals. In the short run, a false prosperity takes root. Business expands, new construction is everywhere, people feel wealthier. This is why there is always such political pressure on the Fed to lower rates around election time. The prosperity comes in the short run, and the painful correction comes much later, well after people have cast their votes. As these borrowers spend the money they borrowed and compete with each other for resources, the result is a rise in prices and interest rates. This is how the economy reveals that more long-term projects have begun than can be sustained in light of current resource availability. Some of them have to be abandoned, with all the dislocation that entails, layoffs, squandered capital, misdirected resources, and so on. Interest rates were at their initial level for a reason. Savings were low, and therefore, with little for investors to borrow, the price of borrowing, in effect, the interest rate, was high. Had market-determined interest rates prevailed, investors would have been discouraged from excessive borrowing to finance long-term projects, and the result would have been sustainable investment and growth. Interest rates set by the market coordinate the production process in accordance with real economic conditions. Only the most profitable, socially demanded projects would have been undertaken. When the Federal Reserve artificially lowers rates, on the other hand, it systematically misleads investors and encourages unsustainable economic booms. F.A. Hayek's Nobel Prize in Economics, which was awarded to him in 1974, had to do with exactly this, showing how central bank manipulation of interest rates and money caused havoc throughout the economy and set the stage for an inevitable bust. The Fed often tries to delay the day of reckoning, the painful period when the malinvestments are liquidated and the economy is restored to true health. It will cut rates yet again. The false prosperity continues, but the problem of malinvestment only gets worse. The Fed cannot carry on the charade forever. If it inflates without end, it risks hyperinflation and the destruction of the currency. In some cases, central banks find, after resorting time and again to inflation as a way of encouraging economic activity, that their policies no longer have any discernible effect. The system is simply exhausted. The Japanese economy provides a vivid example of the futility of manipulating interest rates. Japan was in the economic doldrums throughout the 1990s, despite its central bank's rate cuts. Ultimately, interest rates were cut to zero, where they remained for several years. The rate cutting failed to stimulate the economy. Prosperity cannot be created out of thin air by a central bank. This is one reason I was delighted to learn that comedian Jon Stewart, when he had former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan on his program, asked him why we needed a Federal Reserve and why interest rates couldn't simply be set freely on the market. That was a great question, the sort of question non-comedians in America never seem to ask, and Greenspan sputtered around for a response. Even Greenspan's supporters were shocked to observe how poorly he responded to a simple question about the very purpose of the institution he headed for nearly two decades. Central economic planning has been as discredited as any idea can possibly be. But even though we point to our devotion to the free market, at the same time, we centrally plan our monetary system, the very heart of the economy. Americans must reject the notion that one man, whether Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, or any other chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, can know what the proper money supply and interest rates ought to be. Only the market can determine that. Americans must learn this lesson if we want to avoid continuous and deeper recessions and to get the economy growing in a healthy and sustainable fashion. Few Americans during his tenure knew that Greenspan had once been an outspoken advocate of the gold standard as the only monetary system that a free society should consider. Not long after my return to Congress in the election of 1996, I spoke with Greenspan at a special event that took place just before he was to speak in front of the House Banking Committee. At this event, congressmen had a chance to meet and have their picture taken with the Fed chairman. I decided to bring along my original copy of his 1966 article from the Objectivist newsletter called Gold and Economic Freedom, an outstanding piece in which he laid out the economic and moral case for a commodity-based monetary system as against the fiat paper system. He graciously agreed to sign it for me. As he was doing so, I asked if he wanted to write a disclaimer on the article. He replied good-naturedly that he had recently reread the piece and that he would not change a word of it. I found that fascinating. Could it be that, in his heart of hearts, Greenspan still believed in the bulletproof logic of that classic article? Shortly afterward, I decided, perhaps a bit mischievously, to bring up that article and the arguments raised in it during the subsequent Greenspan appearance before the committee. But the Federal Reserve chairman was less congenial when I raised the subject out in the open. He replied curtly that the article I was citing had been written 40 years earlier and that his views had changed since then. Greenspan's real views, however interesting as a piece of trivia, are ultimately unimportant. It is the system itself that matters. In the same way, it is absurd for the Fed chairman to come to Congress and complain that the real problems in the economy stem from deficit spending and that it is solely Congress and its recklessness with the budget that is at fault. That is not so. It is the entire system that is to blame. Congress could not get away with spending beyond our means year after year if we did not have a Federal Reserve system ready to finance it all by purchasing bonds with money it creates out of thin air. What the issue boils down to is, do we want a monetary system that politicians can manipulate to their advantage? Do we want them to have the ability to pay for all their extravagance by printing the money they need, thereby imposing a hidden tax on all Americans by eroding the value of our dollar? Gold cannot be mined as cheaply as Federal Reserve notes can be printed, nor can its supply be manipulated on a daily basis. There is a great dispersion of power in a gold standard system. That is the strength of the system, for it allows the people to check any monetary excesses of their rulers and does not allow the rulers to exploit the people by debasing the money. The gold standard has historically been a bulwark against inflation. It is politically manipulated money such as we have had since the 1930s that causes our inflation. That should not be unexpected or difficult to understand. The supply of gold is relatively fixed and grows only modestly. But in a free economy, capital investment leads to ever greater productivity and the ability to produce more and more goods over time. So with gold relatively stable on the one hand and the supply of goods growing by leaps and bounds on the other, the gold will tend to be worth more and more, and the prices of these goods will be lower and lower. History bears this out. An item that cost $100 in 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, would cost $2,014.81 in 2006. An item that cost $100 in 2006 would have cost $4.96 in 1913. As we can see, the dollar has lost nearly all its value since the Fed was established. Now, if the gold standard had brought about such an outcome, we would never hear the end of all the howls of outrage. But the Fed does it and utter silence. The Fed has managed to insulate itself from the kind of criticism that is normally directed at all other institutions that harm Americans. And in fact, the gold standard did no such thing. People's money increased in value under the gold standard. They were not looted by inflation. An item that cost $100 in 1820 would have cost only $63.02 in 1913. The Federal Reserve now no longer reports the figures on M3, the total money supply. Spokesmen claim that among the reasons for this change is that it costs too much money to gather these figures. This from an institution that creates however much money it wants is off the books and is never audited. To the contrary, the real reason we don't get these figures anymore, I am certain, is that they are too revealing. They tell us more about what the Fed has been up to and the damage it has been doing to our dollar than they care for us to know. Any government that inflates the money supply runs the risk of hyperinflation, which occurs when the money supply is increased so much as to render the currency completely worthless. It can occur very quickly and suddenly, and has a very rapid snowballing effect. The textbook case in the 20th century took place in Germany in 1923, although a worse hyperinflation occurred in Hungary after World War II. When in that year the French occupied the Ruhr Valley, an industrial and resource-rich part of Western Germany, The German government encouraged workers there to go on a general strike and refuse to work. It paid their salaries during that strike by simply printing the necessary money. But the process spun out of the government's control. People could see their money was losing value. They knew that the longer they held it, the less it would buy. So they rushed out to buy anything they could, since just about anything was worth more than the valueless pieces of paper that German marks were rapidly becoming. And the more they spent, the higher prices rose, leading still more people to unload their currency on whatever was for sale in anticipation of still higher prices in the future. The result was the complete ruin of the German mark, which German children began gluing together to make kites and German adults burned in order to keep warm. Who can be surprised to learn that it was also in 1923 that Adolf Hitler made his first attempt to seize power? Intolerance and extremism always find a readier audience in unfavorable or, as in this case, chaotic economic times. In the United States, November 2007 alone saw wholesale prices increase by 3.2%, an annualized rate of nearly 40%. With all manner of bailouts contemplated for mortgage lenders and the Federal Reserve committed to ever more money creation, are we so sure that hyperinflation could not occur here? In fact, that outcome becomes more likely every day. Inflation of the money supply also produces financial bubbles and instability. The monetary inflation of the 1990s helped yield $145 billion in profits for the NASDAQ companies between 1996 and 2000. That entire amount was then lost in a single year, not to mention the trillions of dollars of paper losses in stock values from their peak in early 2000. Politicians are all tears and pity about large stock market losses, but they never make a connection between the bubble economy and the monetary inflation generated by the Federal Reserve. Congress has chosen instead to blame the analysts for misleading investors, a drop in the bucket compared to the misleading information for which the Federal Reserve has been responsible. What with the artificially low interest rates it has brought about, and a financial market made flush with a generous new credit at every sign of a correction over the past 10 years. By preventing the liquidation of bad debt and the elimination of malinvestment and overcapacity, the Federal Reserve's actions help keep financial bubbles inflated and make the eventual collapse all the more severe. It is this, the Fed's policy of artificially cheap credit, that caused the housing bubble that has caused so many Americans so much grief. Banks, awash in reserves created out of thin air by the Fed, began making mortgage loans to just about anyone. With credit freely available, people bought larger and more expensive homes than would otherwise have made sense. They were set up for disaster, when reality would inevitably reassert itself amid the fantasy world the Fed had created. Using money zero maturity figures, we find that the increase in mortgage debt since the 2001 recession is equal to the Fed's increase in the money supply. That is where the new money went, and it is where the housing bubble came from. And it wasn't just that people were enticed by all the available credit into living beyond their means. The housing bubble caused them to make other destructive and unwise decisions as well. With real estate prices artificially inflated, people felt wealthier. In light of how wealthy the value of their homes made them feel, they saved less. And the economist Mark Thornton puts it, Americans began using their homes as giant ATMs to withdraw cash from the equity they had built up. The 1990s witnessed a dramatic upward trend in new housing starts. Revealingly, no downturn in housing starts was observed during the 2001 recession, the only recession on record in which no such downturn has taken place. Few Americans will be surprised at the statistics. Between 1998 and 2005, home prices increased by 45%. As Thornton points out, that figure is all the more remarkable when we remember all the forces that were simultaneously putting downward pressure on home prices including new home building technology, an increased supply of lower-priced labor, mainly from Mexico, and the fact that new housing tends to be built on lower-priced land. That prices could nevertheless rise so sharply is a sign of the severity of the bubble. All this has real consequences for real people. As the bubble bursts, many will face foreclosure or bankruptcy and will see their credit ratings decimated. Construction firms will face hard times, and unemployment in the industry will rise sharply. The effects on the wider economy could be equally devastating. In the midst of this disaster, where are those who will point the finger where it belongs? Who will call the Federal Reserve to account for injecting into the economy all the funny money that created the housing bubble in the first place? Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan once boasted that the Fed's policy had helped many more people buy homes. Those boasts became scarcer as the bubble began to burst and people's lives were thrown into turmoil. Government intervention always has unintended consequences that cause harm, a truism that applies just as strongly to interventions into the monetary system. Devastated homeowners are only the latest victims. All kinds of easy options were available to just about anyone with any credit worthiness, including tiny or no down payments and adjustable rate or interest-only mortgages. People who wanted to follow a more traditional path to home ownership, such as a fixed-rate mortgage and a 20% down payment, were completely shut out of this housing market, yet another perverse effect of the bubble. So, what should be done? First of all, it's long past time to put the monetary issue back on the table as a subject for genuine discussion and then to start asking some forbidden questions. For over 100 years, the money issue has been absent from our political process. No political campaign has focused on it or even said much of anything about it. For most people, in fact, the Fed is a complete mystery, its operations incomprehensible. That seems to be just the way the Fed likes it. We are supposed to be bored by it. We are supposed to treat it as a given, like the air we breathe. We are supposed to have confidence in it. Surely the experts who run our monetary system for us, and who of course have a vested interest in perpetuating the system we now have, couldn't be giving us bad advice. But point to it as the source of our eroding standard of living, the ravages of the boom-bust business cycle, and the financial bubbles that have ruined countless Americans? That is simply not to be found anywhere along the spectrum of allowable opinion in America. It's time for some fresh thinking for a change, an unbiased, rational reappraisal of a monetary system that is presented to us as the best of all possible worlds, but whose dangers grow clearer and more urgent with each passing day. The first practical measure that should be taken is to legalize competition. Restore to Americans their right to use precious metals as a medium of exchange, a simple and reasonable initial step if we believe in freedom. It is essential that Americans be given the chance to escape from the system and protect themselves from possible financial ruin by being able to use gold and silver if they so desire. If anyone would rather continue to transact in the depreciating dollar, he would be free to do so. But anyone who prefers a currency that holds its value and won't become worthless before his eyes just because his government ran the printing press one too many times would have real options. Right now, various disabilities make it difficult for gold to be used in market transactions. Sales and capital gains taxes on precious metals should be promptly repealed, and the enforceability of gold clauses in private contracts definitively reaffirmed. What other policy for sheltering Americans from the collapse of the dollar is being advanced? Is there any, apart from comforting delusions that the Federal Reserve, which is itself responsible for our financial mess, can be trusted to put everything right? For one thing, how can we be expected to place so much trust in a Federal Reserve system we're not even allowed to audit? And even if the Fed chairman really possessed the singular genius our media and politicians regularly ascribe to him, no matter who he is, what if things have reached the point at which the Fed simply cannot stop the collapse? What if economic law, which the Fed can no more defy than it can repeal the law of gravity, is about to hit the Fed and the American people like a tidal wave, before which little rate cuts here and there are like the tiny umbrella Wile E. Coyote puts over his head to protect himself from falling boulders. In other words, what if I and other sound money advocates are right? If we're wrong, then all we've done is eliminate some taxes on gold and silver. No harm done. But if we're right, we've given the American people a crucial safety net against financial collapse. Tinkering here and there is not the solution. But as I've said, it is the only proposal Americans are permitted to hear. It is long past time that we begin asking fundamental questions rather than trivial ones, that we educate the people rather than distract or confuse them. Simply trying to patch up monetary problems after they've occurred, whether it is the NASDAQ bubble or the housing bubble, neglects to treat the root of the problem and must therefore fail. We cannot solve the problems of inflation with more inflation. We need to ask, how did we get here? What causes these bubbles? Financial bubbles simply happen, the political establishment tells us. These bubbles are an unfortunate but inevitable side effect of a market economy. That is nonsense. But it is convenient nonsense for some people, and that's why it gets repeated so often. It gives the perpetrators of the financial debacle that now confronts us a chance to get off the hook. We shouldn't let them. Chapter 7. The Revolution. I have heard it said that mankind does not want freedom, that people are happy to be slaves as long as they are entertained and well-fed. I have likewise heard it said that most Americans have bought into the version of events that are given in the mainstream media and are perfectly content to be told what to think, what is good, what is bad, who is politically acceptable, who is politically unacceptable. I don't believe this for a second. For one thing, our own American Revolution would have been impossible if this mentality had prevailed. Contrary to what many Americans have been taught, a majority, not a minority, of the colonists supported the fight for liberty against Great Britain. John Adams is often misquoted as saying that one-third of Americans supported the Revolution, one-third opposed it, and one-third were indifferent. Historians have repeated this incorrect quotation time and again. Adams was, in fact, speaking of American support for the French Revolution. Historian William F. Marina has shown convincingly that a majority of Americans supported the American Revolution. The fact is, liberty is not given a fair chance in our society, neither in the media, nor in politics, nor especially in education. I have spoken to many young people during my career, some of whom had never heard my ideas before. But as soon as I explained the philosophy of liberty and told them a little American history in light of that philosophy, their eyes lit up. Here was something they'd never heard before, but something that was compelling and moving, and which appealed to their sense of idealism. Liberty had simply never been presented to them as a choice. We are engaged in a great battle of ideas, and the choices before us could not be clearer. I urge those who agree with this important message to educate themselves in the scholarship of liberty. Read the books I recommend in my reading list. Learn from the Mises Institute and Mises.org, the most heavily trafficked economics website in the world. Visit LouRockwell.com, an outstanding and crucially important website I visit every day. I have devoted this book to ideas that I consider important, if typically neglected, if our country is to restore its former self. How much of my program could be accomplished in a presidential term or in a decade or two, I do not know. But a bare minimum of what the successor to George W. Bush should seek to achieve, I suggest the following. First, we need to rethink what the role of government ought to be, and fast. If we continue to think of our government as the policeman of the world and as the great provider from cradle to grave, our problems will grow worse and worse, and our downward economic spiral, the first signs of which we are now witnessing, will only accelerate. The role of world policeman has made our country poorer and less safe. The welfare state, likewise, threatens our financial solvency and has caused the once robust institutions of civil society, which are no longer needed when government performs all functions, to atrophy. Right now, our government is borrowing $2.2 billion every day, mainly from China and Japan, to pay for our overseas empire. As our dollar continues to decline, thanks to Federal Reserve inflation, the American debt instruments that these countries are holding lose their value. We cannot expect these and other countries to hold on to them forever. And when they decide that they no longer wish to, our fantasy world comes crashing down on us. No more empire, no more pledging ever more trillions in new entitlements. Reality will set in, and it will be severe. Our present course, in short, is not sustainable. Recall the statistics. In order to meet our long-term entitlement obligations, we would need double-digit growth rates for 75 consecutive years. When was the last time we had double-digit growth for even 1 year? Our spendthrift ways are going to come to an end one way or another. Politicians won't even mention the issue, much less face up to it, since the collapse is likely to occur sometime beyond their typical 2 to 4 year time horizon. They hope and believe that the American people are too foolish, uninformed, and short-sighted to be concerned, and that they can be soothed with pleasant slogans and empty promises of more and more loot. To the contrary, more and more intelligent Americans are waking up to the reality of our situation every day. Now, we can face the problem like adults and transition our way out of a financially impossible situation gradually and with foresight, with due care for those who have been taught to rely on government assistance. In the short run, this approach would continue the major federal programs on which Americans have been taught to be dependent. But in accordance with our Constitution, it would eventually leave states, localities, and extended families to devise workable solutions for themselves. Or we can wait for the inevitable collapse and try to sort things out in the midst of unprecedented economic chaos. I know which option I prefer. No one who has learned to be dependent on these programs needs to be thrown into the street. But in the long run, these programs are insolvent. If we do not begin the transition process funded by savings from our bloated overseas presence, everyone will be out in the street because the programs will simply collapse. Americans were given an implied contract when they began paying into Social Security, so we should not want to strip away from them the resources they understandably anticipated receiving upon retirement. Contrary to popular belief, right now, money for Social Security recipients comes not from some trust fund into which people have paid over the course of their working lives. If congressmen had voted the way I consistently have, I have never voted to spend a single penny out of Social Security, then we would not face nearly so serious a problem. The fact is, there is no money in any trust fund. The government spent it on other things. The money that retirees receive comes directly from current workers. Current workers are not building up a Social Security nest egg for themselves. They are giving their money to current recipients and hoping there will be enough workers to support them when they reach retirement age. But no part of the system involves paying money to the government and receiving that money with interest after a certain age. The government feeds into that illusion, but it is an illusion all the same. I have long favored giving young people the right to opt out of Social Security, since such an option follows naturally from my belief in individual liberty. But since current Social Security recipients are being supported by tax receipts from current workers, how would those people be cared for if young people began opting out? The transition period should be funded by curtailing our overseas expenditures, which are not only out of control, but have also compromised our real security interests by spreading our forces so thin. If we really oppose big government, we cannot make an artificial exception for bloated military bureaucracies, which traditional budget-minded conservatives never hesitated to look at seriously as a source of potential savings. As many empires throughout history have learned too late, more is not always better. In this way, we can phase in the ideas of responsibility and self-reliance, common sense ideas to which young people respond very favorably when I mention them. In addition, the budgets of every federal cabinet department should at the very least be immediately frozen, a policy that all responsible people can surely embrace. Everyone should be forced to live within his or her means, all the more so when we are speaking of federal agencies for which the Constitution makes no provision. Most departments, with the exception of state, defense, and justice, deal with matters that our Constitution properly leaves to the states or to the people, and the people should no longer be exploited to support them. For too long, swarms of Washington bureaucrats have grown fat with wealth and power, all in the name of the common good, they assure us, at the expense of the beleaguered American people. That must come to an end. Forget all the protest we'll hear about how indispensable these departments are. Departments Americans got by very well without for more than 80% of our history, I might add. We do not have the resources for them. That is the point. And more forced labor to fund them is neither morally acceptable nor economically wise. It is only our intellectual inertia and lack of imagination that make us think these departments necessary in the first place. A federal Department of Education, for example, is an insult to the American people, who are more than capable of running their own schools without being looted to support a national education bureaucracy. We would get by just fine without it, as indeed Americans did for most of the 20th century, a period when, by just a coincidence, the population was far better educated than it is now. In fact, given the Department of Education's sorry record, if I truly opposed learning and knowledge, I would propose tripling its budget. If we adopted a sensible policy like this, the very announcement would restore strength to the dollar. And the more we lived within our means, the less inflation we would have, and the less the poor and middle class would suffer, since there would be less pressure on the Fed to monetize debt. We also need to begin to restore monetary freedom, which means that Americans should be free, if they wish, to engage in transactions and contracts denominated in gold and silver. It is essential that Americans be able to protect themselves in this way against any coming monetary disaster that would leave them holding valueless dollar bills. No one in politics or the media even talks about the issue, so you know it must be important. There is much that the president cannot do on his own, and that requires the approval of Congress. He may earnestly recommend certain courses of action and try to rally the public behind them, but the initiative rests with Congress. Everything we have described in this chapter thus far falls into this category. At the same time, in areas critical to the health of our republic, the president holds tremendous power for good in his own hands. For one thing, every president sets priorities in the enforcement of laws and how he directs the attorney general. Just because the federal government has been given a power does not mean it must be exercised. The president could simply declare that the executive branch will direct no resources to the prosecution of medical marijuana patients. He could refuse to violate habeas corpus. He could refuse to detain people forever without legal counsel and without even knowing the charges against them. He can take these and other sensible measures even if Congress should refuse to curtail runaway executive authority, since the president is nowhere obligated to exercise such authority. And he can not only refuse to issue any more unconstitutional executive orders, but he can even issue an executive order repealing those that previous presidents have issued. In foreign policy, the president, as commander-in-chief, can order the troops brought home from Iraq in a matter of months, not years, a policy no top Democratic candidate will commit to. Again, so much for the opposition party. We are told by the war propagandists that such a withdrawal will lead to chaos, as if chaos did not exist there already. But these are the same people who also assured us that the war would be a breeze and that the whole thing would be paid for out of oil revenues. why should we take their predictions seriously ever again? In the case of Vietnam, which is now a trading partner and has a functioning stock market, we have accomplished much more in peace than we ever did in an enormously costly war. Particularly in light of the National Intelligence Estimate that was released in December 2007, the President should order the Navy to back off the shores of Iran and make clear that we have no intention of attacking that country. The President should likewise declare that the United States is abandoning its isolationist posture of refusing major diplomatic contact with Iran, and that he is willing to talk with Iranian leaders, just as American presidents talked to Soviet and Chinese leaders throughout the Cold War. The sanctions against Iran should also be removed as a further indication of our country's shift away from isolationism. The price of oil would shoot downward, and the dollar would move upward on the basis of these announcements. The United States would suddenly become diplomatically credible once again for the first time in years. The isolationism that our leaders have imposed on us would now be reversed, as our government once again observes basic norms of conduct to which all countries are expected to conform. No longer would the White House, which is now viewed throughout the world the way the free world once viewed Pravda, the old communist newspaper, bombard the international community with a ceaseless barrage of war-justifying propaganda that no one anywhere, apart from the gullible and often complicit American media, actually believes. And no longer would the patriotic sentiments of decent Americans be exploited on behalf of wars that have more to do with imperial ambition than with American security. In other words, we need to keep our wits about us and replace our bull-in-a-china-shop foreign policy with a statesmanlike approach that is appropriate to the real needs of American security. We also need to stand firmly against moral relativism, recalling that actions do not become moral just because our government performs them. And if we really oppose isolationism, as all our politicians assure us they do, then sanctions against Cuba should be lifted as well. Sanctions hurt the target population, but rarely do serious harm to the targeted regime. How well have our sanctions succeeded in getting rid of Fidel Castro, who has happily exploited the sanctions in order to posture as an anti-American martyr oppressed by Yankee wickedness? There is no reason that Americans should not be free to travel and trade with Cuba. When I said so in a Miami Republican debate, the response was not unexpected. Afterward, though, I spoke to a huge rally, with Cuban Americans making up 70% of those in attendance, where everyone cheered the message of freedom. It seems to be a generational issue. Younger people, not emotionally or politically attached to our failed policy, know the Cuban regime's days are numbered, no matter what, and that freedom, as usual, is the most morally attractive position for America to take, starting right now. It is also time to begin bringing American troops home from around the world, an absolute necessity if the budget is ever to be brought under control. We're going broke, and we still have 75,000 troops in Germany? Talk about being frozen in the past. The President should notify our allies of the policy, which no one ever told Americans was to be in effect indefinitely, and then begin a withdrawal. We have not had a foreign policy that is proper to a republic for many, many years, and it is long past time that we reestablished one. If we did, Americans would be safer, our military would be more efficient and effective, and we would make an excellent start toward restoring our international competitiveness. Other countries, after all, are not burdened with the same self-imposed overseas expenditures with which the federal government has weighed down the American economy for so many years. What I am describing is the only realistic option Americans have. That is, it would be their most realistic option if anyone in our government would actually offer it to them. The alternative consists of an ever-growing financial burden, more police state measures, and an endless string of wars pitched to Americans on the basis of now familiar propaganda and financed by more borrowing, higher taxes, and more money printed out of thin air. The collapse of the dollar will not be far behind. The empire game our government has been playing is coming to an end one way or another. This is the fate of all empires. They overextend themselves and then suffer a financial catastrophe, typically involving the destruction of the currency. We are already seeing the pattern emerging in our own case. We can either withdraw gracefully, as I propose, or we can stay in our fantasy world and wait until bankruptcy forces us to scale back our foreign commitments. Again, I know which option I prefer. Will it be difficult? Perhaps, though not nearly as much as some people think. We would finally begin to pull ourselves out from the crushing burden of debt and unfunded obligations that have hung over our economy for far too long. Our country would enjoy far more robust economic performance than we have seen in many decades. Rich and poor alike could once again look to the future with confidence instead of a sense of foreboding. Doing nothing would be far more difficult. In my travels around the country, I have discovered that young people are waking up to reality faster than anyone else, since they realize that the cosmetic changes our political class is calling for will do nothing to prevent the financial catastrophe they are now fearing they will inherit. What decent parents would want to do such a thing to their children? Ours is not a fated existence, for nowhere is our destiny etched in stone. In the final analysis, the last line of defense in support of freedom and the Constitution consists of the people themselves. If the people want to be free, if they want to lift themselves out from underneath a state apparatus that threatens their liberties, squanders their resources on needless wars, destroys the value of their dollar, and spews forth endless propaganda about how indispensable it is and how lost we would all be without it, there is no force that can stop them. If freedom is what we want, it is ours for the taking. Let the revolution begin.
This has been an Hachette audio production of The Revolution, written by Ron Paul and read by Bob Craig. Produced and directed by Dave Giorgio. Production supervised by Michelle McGonigal. The Revolution is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group USA. Text copyright 2008 by Ron Paul. Audio production copyright 2008, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system, without the written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.